cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks the Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined, as always, by John Mariano. How are you today, John?
I am committed to this show.
I thought when you said, I thought you were just going to stop at I am committed, and I would have said finally. But no, you're still out, huh?
Listen, they haven't found me yet. I'm not telling them my location. You're not to tell them my location. I am pledging my commitment to this show.
Okay. So we're in this for the long haul, huh? We're going to do this for a couple thousand shows, 20 years. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we still got to record more Aerosmith, but between this and Aerosmith, we should be busy a while.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. We're not going to run out of things to talk about or great music from movies because, oh God. And as soon as we started talking about the show, I had about 200 songs just immediately pop into mind. Like, oh, we got to do this. Oh, we got to do this. Oh, we got to do this. And we're getting another one of mine this week, John, and I'm very excited about that. We're two episodes in. What do you think of our selection so far?
I'm enjoying it. So wait, let me get this straight. So you're going the route of the music inspires you and you're picking the movie that aligns with the music? Is it like what's your thought process in picking these songs?
I'm picking songs that I like from movies that I like.
Well, no, I follow that. But like you, the way you just talked about it was like you have like 200 songs in mind. Right, where I have like a library of movies. I don't want to make it sound like it's more than 200, but it's more than 200. Mm-hmm. And like I have these moments from movies, like almost like movie trailer moments that stick out in my head. And like the sounds that go with it are equally married to it. But I feel like the image leads my thought and then the sound goes with it. How about you?
A little of that and maybe some of the opposite too, you know, sometimes it's from the music perspective. So we'll attack it a few different ways. Sometimes it's just, hey, there's like five idiots in a car headbanging to Bohemian Rhapsody.
But you see, we give the audience a much more enlightening answer when you choose not to be snarky, Corey.
I never choose not to be snarky when I'm with you, John. You bring out the worst in me.
That's why we work so well together.
That is why we work so well together. And that's why we're doing podcast number two. Theme music, we're talking about music from movies, TV shows, commercials. You're going to break out a commercial parody or a commercial song here at some point, I'm sure. You're big on jingles, right, John?
Jingles, jangles, the whole thing.
The whole shebang. And I can't wait. Show number four is a John. He's already let me know what it's going to be. Look forward to that teaser trailer coming up at the end of the show. But today, it's another one of mine, and I'm going back to one of my favorite all-time movies. If you've clicked on this episode, you know the name already. It's from The Commitments, a fantastic movie from 1991, directed by Alan Parker, about, it's the tale of Jimmy Rabbit, a young Irish lad who's a music fanatic and wants to put together his own soul band. And, of course, every good band has a "the" in the name. Not and, which his guitar player wanted to name him at one point, but he chooses The Commitments, and it's about their, adventures playing soul music around Ireland in the 90s. So that's a great, great movie. If you haven't seen it, by all means, go check it out. John, have you ever seen The Commitments?
I did. It was, I remember it being sort of a big deal when it came out, simply because of the music. And I was very interested in it because of the music. And, you know, I grew up, my mom was a big Motown fan. So I grew up a lot on like the Temptations, the Supremes, things like that. And this felt like a celebration of that style of music in a lot of ways. And because of that, I was very in tune with this movie when it came out.
And all those bands you just named have "the" in the title. All the best bands have "the." They're "the" somethings.
I mean, all the best bands have "the" in the title. I don't know about that, Corey. We actually do a podcast about a band that's one of the best bands ever. They do not have "the" in the title.
No,
you do. You do another podcast about one of the greatest bands of all time. Do not have "the" in the title. I'm also a Led Zeppelin fan. No, "the," right? There are plenty of bands that don't have "the," but there are many great bands that do have "the," right? The Beatles, the Rolling Stones.
I think Jimmy Rabbit was more thinking more of soul bands, like the Temptations and and that kind of thing.
But I could just as easily go with like R&B performers and whatnot and soul performers, and give me a little Marvin Gaye, right? And he's not the, I mean, he is the Marvin Gaye,
too, but he's also not a band. Right? Oh. Jimmy Rabbit's reasoning was the best soul bands have the in the title. I should have prefaced with soul.
I'm going to derail you as long as I can, because you know that on Twitter they're going to kill you for just throwing the word "the" out there arbitrarily.
They're going to kill me on Twitter for anything, just for even doing a podcast. There's going to be a dozen people calling me a jackass daily. And by all means, when it means you're listening to the show, have at her. I am a jackass. I can take it. But let's get back to the movie, John. And you said that you kind of knew it through the music. And actually, this soundtrack was quite popular. The movie wasn't. And I'm going to use that term that you love so much, cult classic, because it's grown quite a cult following nowadays. But back in 91, it only grossed about $14 million, released by 20th Century Fox, if I remember correctly. But the soundtrack went triple platinum, based just on the amazing group of talent that Alan Parker and the producers were able to put together for this film. A lot of unknowns, a lot of Irish unknowns. There was no stars in this movie. Brought them all together. And put the band together, put the Commitments together, and they released two soundtrack albums from this movie. The first one going triple platinum, and the big hit from that album that is still played to this day, you know, around hockey rinks and baseball games and football games, is Mustang Sally. So that's the one we're covering here today.
I just want to get into the song, Corey. Like, I have some comments and thoughts, but I don't want to derail the show any further. I want to keep the focus on the music, at least at the top of it. I do have some thoughts. I have a question for you after we get through the song.
Okay, let's get her going. This is Mustang Sally from The Commitments.
Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow than Mustang down.
All right, and that lead you're listening is a young man by the name of Andrew Strong, who I think was around 16 when they were filming The Commitments. He plays Deco Cuff, the lead singer from The Commitments, and his voice is, man, pretty impressive. He had a pretty decent career in Europe after the fact, and you could actually buy a special edition of The Commitments soundtrack that has four of his solo cuts, including a great cover of Some Kind of Wonderful. But you definitely know what you're listening to when you hear Andrew Strong kick in, or the kid's got a hell of a set of pipes on him.
Yeah, it's...
Sorry, I didn't know you were going to add anything. You were just sitting there.
I was just sitting there. I was soaking it in because I was going to ask you what the significance of Mustang Sally is and the performance of this in the movie. Do you remember?
Mustang Sally is the one that, you know, when Jimmy's listening to how they, when you get the, when they got Deco in there and everybody's kind of playing it for the first time, it's kind of that magic moment, like, oh crap, we got something here. Because once he started opening his mouth and you hear those vocals with the band and the band's tight, and then the girls come in with the background vocals coming up pretty quick with Ride Sally Ride, that's where you really get that, you know, Jimmy Rabbit has something here with this group of oddballs he put together. This is actually a pretty killer band.
So, you know, when the audience knows, I wasn't just sitting here blankly. I was actually trying to do some homework on my phone, because while I've seen The Commitments, it came out in 91. I probably saw it in 92 or 93, might have been the last time I've seen it. So you're talking over a lifetime ago that I've seen this movie. So I was trying to bring up some movie facts, so that way I don't sound like a complete idiot as we get through the song. So thanks for calling me out, Corey.
No problem. That's what I'm here for.
Feet on the ground. Sing it through.
All right, that's the Commitment Ets, as they're dubbed in the film. They also take turns singing lead on different tracks in the movie. But Wilson Pickett probably did the most famous version of Mustang Sally, and he actually plays a part in the film too. He's not actually in it, but at the big finale, the Commitments are supposed to be performing at a club, and Wilson Pickett was supposed to come check him out, and he never makes it. I guess I shouldn't give away too many spoilers, should I?
Well, no, you can listen. If you listen to this podcast, it's meant to inspire you to watch the movie or listen to the song and or both. But we're going to be spoiler heavy on this because we have to be. It's the nature of what we're doing. So we appreciate if you understand that a little bit. And Corey, don't apologize. It's your podcast. You're allowed to spoil if you want to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll keep going then, because Wilson Pickett is supposed to show up at the club and listen to the Commitments. This was going to be their big break. The band is very close to breaking up at this point because all the Commitment Ents are sleeping with the saxophone player, and they all find out at the same time. Nobody's getting along with anybody. They all hate the lead singer. The drummer's a felon, all sorts of things. And then at the end of the gig, Jimmy Rabbit's walking home, and a limousine pulls up and asks him where the club is. And Jimmy says, "Oh, it's that way, but you missed it. They're closed." And the limo driver turns to the back and says, "You want to head back to the hotel, Mr. Pickett?" So they just missed Wilson Pickett coming to check out their gig. And it's probably my favorite F-bomb in movie history, too, because the limo pulls away and Jimmy just goes, "Fuck." All you want to do is ride around
Sally. All you want to do is ride around Sally.
What are your thoughts on the music, John? Like I said, there's a bunch of Irish kids they put together for this film. I think they sound pretty tight.
Not only do they sound pretty tight, there was only 5 weeks of rehearsal time that they had. It was a very low budget movie. Mm-hmm. So that's 5 weeks to rehearse the movie and the music. And they sound extremely tight for a band that was cobbled together for a movie. Right? Like this isn't a band that's been playing together for years. They're not jamming out together. You know, they have what I'm guessing is 5 weeks of intense rehearsals and getting the blocking down and getting everything down for the movie and learning how to work together as a band. With all of that in mind, between the production of this and everything else, it sounds fantastic.
And you mentioned those 5 weeks. They had to learn, like, you know, 60, 70 songs. A lot, you know, most of which wouldn't even make the film, but as a band, they had to know them just in case they got selected for the film. So, yeah. And then the filming itself only took 53 days, which, you know, at a big budget film, you're looking at, like, you know, 5-6 months of shooting. You know, that's not even two. So, pretty impressive.
And in case people were wondering, why would they have to learn 50 or 60 songs? That much, I'm going to assume, goes into the licensing, because it's so hard to get a hold of the licensing rights to these songs that they didn't know which songs they'd have permission to use. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily them being indecisive about which songs to use. They didn't know what they were going to be allowed to use and what was going to fit in the budget. So if they only learned, say, 16 or 17 songs, then they had to use those songs, and whatever they were going to charge for them, they were stuck playing that price. It gave them a little bit more flexibility in the budget. So Corey, earlier in the song, you brought up the Commitment Ets, and I was just following along, and one of them didn't have the proper accent. She was from Northern Ireland, not Dublin. So in this truncated time of learning songs and all this other crazy stuff going on and learning your role and your lines, she had to learn how to do a Dublin accent on top of everything else. Because
was that Maria Doyle?
I believe so. Yeah. But what's crazy is here in America, we around the same time had a Robin Hood who didn't bother learning an accent at all.
That's very true. That would have been right around the same period, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Maria Doyle, one of the few cast members who actually went on and had a pretty decent singing career after The Commitments. One of the Corrs, if you remember that band, Andrea Corr, had a small role as Jimmy Rabbit's sister, Sharon. And then the only other cast member I can really think of that did anything in film was Bronagh Gallagher, who played one of the shuttle pilots who gets blown up right at the beginning of Star Wars Episode One.
I stand corrected. It was Bronagh Gallagher.
Okay.
Who had to learn the accent. I was just double checking the article. I had glanced at it fast and just erroneously agreed with you because I was trying to keep the show moving.
Well, and maybe nobody would have picked up on that. I'm sure somebody out there is a total commitments head, right? A little bit screaming at their podcast player. These idiots don't know anything.
You know how Twitter sensitive I am, Corey. And I want to make sure Twitter's going to go, at least that idiot had the brains to correct himself on the podcast.
There you go. Well done, my friend. I just want to point out, like, the production of this sounds incredible. Like, it's nice and crisp and everything sounds great. But for the movie, they recorded the performances live on set, which hardly ever happens, right? Usually actors are performing to pre-recorded tracks, but Alan Parker really wanted to, you know, kind of, you know, create that band atmosphere. And like, you're listening to these guys raw and uncensored in a way. So all the songs were recorded live on set, especially the rehearsals. And then they used out-of-phase speakers, which enabled them to play pre-recorded tracks at maximum volume that created a live performance atmosphere. And then they were recorded onto a 24-track recorder. But I just thought, because the rehearsal stuff is really great in this movie, and the fact that it was all recorded live on set is pretty unique.
That is unique. And going back into like the song choices we were talking about earlier, Corey, so the one of the producers listened to thousands of songs from the 60s and submitted a short list to the director of 1,000 possible song choices, which was then whittled down to 300 songs from the 60s before coming down to a list of 75 songs. Like, the pre-production on this movie sounds insane. Like, that represents about 7 months worth of pre-production right there. And most of that's just song selection.
Mm-hmm. And then you got to cast the movie and, you know, pick all these kids who could not only play their instruments perfectly and sing fantastic, but get the accents right and everything else.
Corey, we haven't even talked about, I don't know, things like storyboarding, cinematography, like the things that actually go into doing a visual medium like a movie. Like, we're really just talking about production of a band. This is a production of a band with the added hectic schedule of a film and a budget of a low budget film on top of this. This was like a $15 million film. Like, this was not even for its day, this was not a big budget movie.
No, you're very right. And only grossed, well, yeah, it was budgeted at 12 to 15 million. It only grossed 14.5 million, but that has found kind of a new life on DVD and Blu-ray, to the point where a couple of the stars from the film actually still tour as the stars of the Commitments, even though there's only like two of them. I believe the bass player is one of them, and maybe the drummer as well. Sometimes the sax player joins them as well, but there's only two members of the cast, but they just found some more British or European musicians, and they still go out and tour as the Commitments. So that's kind of cool.
And for any of you non-cinephiles out there, I know we're saying like it's a $50 million budget, and Corey's saying it made $14 million back. So it only sounds like it lost a million, but that's not the case, because with film, marketing budget is typically you double the budget of the movie. Mm-hmm. So if it's a $15 million movie, it's another $15 million in marketing. So you're talking that the studio spent about $30 million and lost $16 million on this movie.
But they would have made that back in home video, because like I said, it really got a second lease on life in home video. So eventually all those movies that don't turn a profit at the box office eventually will, when you factor in home video sales, rentals, and the soundtrack, which I mentioned has sold 12 million copies worldwide.
And you know what's insane, Corey? Is that when this movie comes out, right, back in, what was it, 91?
Yep.
So the studio can file this as a loss in their taxes. So they're making that on all ends, because they file it as a loss and eventually it becomes profitable.
Yep.
Good for them.
Yeah, and it probably turned a profit in 92. So, yeah, it worked out pretty well for them. All right, that's Mustang Sally from 1991's The Commitments, one of my favorite all-time movies. And I want to give a special shout-out at this point to my friend Jeff Allen, who I went to film school with way back in the 1990s. He introduced me to this movie in 1992. I remember seeing the poster around, never did see the film. He's like, no, you got to watch this movie. It uses the F-word more than any other movie I've ever seen. And he was right. It's in almost every other word, but it's really funny. It's heartwarming. It's just a pleasure to watch and listen to. This is one of my favorite soundtracks of all time for one of my favorite movies of all time. John, you weren't real familiar with the film. After hearing one of the tunes, are you going to check it out now?
I'll watch it again. Like, I have nothing against this movie at all. Like, I remember enjoying it when it came out. It's just not something that you actively go and chase down if it didn't strike you as one of your favorites. I have smaller movies that I enjoy and are part of my like core, the way this is part of your core. I will absolutely check it out just for the soundtrack, dude.
It is more than worth it, my friend. So that's my second choice to go on our Spotify playlist that we got going on here. But that means show four is another Johnny pick. And John, but, I know you got something going on.
Before we go there, Corey, mm-hmm. I had a question that popped in my head before we listened to the song.
Okay.
I couldn't answer it before I heard the song. But there are plenty of movie fictitious bands that we're going to cover, movies and television and whatnot. But we'll stick to movies for now because it's just easier. Are the Commitments a top five? And don't just say yes right off the bat. Like, really let it settle in you for a minute. Don't answer like what else goes in it. But are they a top five fictional band from movies in your mind?
In my mind? Yeah. When you say fictional band from movies, three jump to mind immediately. One is the Commitments. One is the fictional band that was from the movie we covered on episode one, Almost Famous, and the band Stillwater. And the third is a movie that's going to have a sequel coming out in a year or two that I'm greatly anticipating, a little English band known as Spinal Tap. So I would absolutely put the Commitments in that kind of rarefied air on my list. How about you, thinking about fictional bands? I'm sure you got a pretty good list too.
I have a solid top 10, Corey. And I feel like the Commitments are settled in neatly between 5 and 10. I don't know that they crack my top 5, but I feel really strong that my top 5 justifies them getting bumped out of it.
Okay.
And we'll cover. And Stillwater, they're on the bubble. They might be my 5 or my 6. I feel like The Commitments are my seven, and I have probably like a solid top five bands in there.
And is your number one still the Zach Attack from Saved by the Bell?
You would think that, but maybe not.
Oh, they've been usurped as number one. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, but I can't wait to get to those.
We will. And there's at least one band that you didn't mention that you're going to kick yourself.
Well, and I thought of a fourth, actually, while you were chatting there. And how could I forget the O'Neaters or the Wonders from That Thing You Do?
That's a good band. It's a very good band. But there is still one band. And we're not going to, even if you think about it right now, don't bring it up. It will be a tease. But we will cover one of their songs, I promise you, on this podcast. But we'll probably do it for like a big episode, like maybe episode 10, maybe episode 25. Like it's a milestone kind of thing when we cover them.
Oh, man, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Well, like you said, no more guessing, no more teases. But why don't you give us a little tease on the song we're going to cover next week?
So I, being of Italian heritage, have an affinity for organized crime movies.
Obviously.
And you know, I love the Goodfellas movie. I love the Godfathers. But I also like when movies send them up. And one of the most famous send-ups of the genre is My Blue Heaven, and it does it in wonderful ways. And at some point, we'll talk about that on this podcast. I feel like there is a movie in that genre or subgenre of satirizing organized crime movies that gets woefully overlooked. And I think there's a conspiracy that's trying to erase it from history. And there's my tease, and you guys can try to look it up on the internet. And within the void of the internet somewhere is the hidden fact that this movie is being buried by somebody somewhere.
There you have it, folks. Next week, we're covering a song from The Irishman, because I found that movie absolutely hilarious. No, I'm just kidding. I know what movie John is talking about, and I can't imagine a lot of the audience does. It'll be interesting to see.
But just to capitalize on what Corey said, even though it's an organized crime movie, and I am of Italian descent, it is an Irish family name in the movie.
There you have it. All right, but that's next week. But until then, on behalf of my good friend John Mariano, my name is Corey Morissette, and I'm going to leave you with some parting words from one Jimmy Rabbit from The Commitments. Good night, everybody.
So looking back, Jimmy, what do you feel you've learned most from your experience with The Commitments? Well, that's a tricky question, Terry, but as I always say, we skipped the light fandango, turned cartwheels across the floor. I was feeling kind of seasick, but the crowd called out for more. That's very profound, Jimmy. What does it mean? Oh, fuck if I know, Terry. All you gotta do.